The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and tonight we're going to focus on two organizations who call Massachusetts their home. Actually, my first guest home is more like the oceans of the world. He is Mark Abbott, the president and director of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. And one place they're currently exploring is something called the Twilight Zone.
Well, it's the area between about 600 to 3,000 feet. It's called the Twilight Zone because you sort of see sunlight, but you can't really photosynthesize. That is, plants can't grow down there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a vast area. It's thought that there may be 10 to 100 times more biomass, living material, in that part of the ocean than we harvest every year.
And then you will hear from Louis Dubay, the executive director of iCivics, founded in 2009 by Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Justice O'Connor is the force behind, of all things, a video game to teach civics to young people.
It really is an amazing thing that she was open to that. She had never, of course, opened much of a computer in her lifetime.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So she had clerks and other staff to do that. But she really saw the power. She also met with Jim Gee, a professor mm-hmm. of probably the father of educational gaming.
Yep.
And he was really able to convince her that really that process of engagement where you can actually simulate something in real life, but at scale for every kid in America, is the way to engage them in the beginning of what their role will be as citizens.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, September 23rd. More than a year after he first solicited suggestions via Twitter about a philanthropy strategy, Amazon founder Jeff Bezos announced a commitment of $2 billion that would fund nonprofits that help the homeless and also create new nonprofit preschools in low-income communities. A coalition of 29 philanthropies have pledged $4 billion over the next 5 years to combat climate change, the largest ever philanthropic investment focused on climate change mitigation. Fundraising revenue fell 2.1% during the first half of 2018 compared with the same period last year. According to the second Goalkeepers report by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the percentage of the global population living on less than $1.90 a day has dropped from 36% in 1990 to just 9% in 2017. Now, at the same time, extreme poverty is becoming heavily concentrated in sub-Saharan African countries, where 22% of the population lives on less than $1.90 a day, and where 86% of the poorest people in the world are projected to live in 2050. Starting next fall, the University of Pennsylvania will offer what it says is the first online bachelor's degree at an Ivy League college, an illustration of the growing credibility and popularity of online education. And as part of Paris's push to drastically limit the number of cars, it's having its annual day of letting pedestrians see what the city would be like if it were designed just for them. On October 16th, the entire city of Paris will be car-free for the day. And finally, the cover story from this month's Chronicle of Philanthropy is on corporate giving, what businesses want, and how nonprofits can effectively work with companies and benefit. And here from the Chronicle to discuss it with us is Dan Parks. Good evening, Dan.
Good talking with you, Denver.
Let me ask you first to provide just a little bit of context. Now, according to Giving USA, total giving in the U.S. last year was about $410 billion. What percentage of that is from corporations?
Only about 5% of that comes from corporations. The rest comes from other sources, namely foundations and people like you and me who give smaller amounts of money on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. Well, the article points out that corporate philanthropy and corporate social responsibility, well, they're being redefined. In what way is that happening, Dan?
Corporations are becoming more and more upfront about the fact that they want their partnerships with nonprofits to fit with their corporate strategies. Now, that's always been the case, that corporations are looking for ways to sort of bolster their their brand and their image and what they do, but they're being more specific about it and in a wider variety of ways as well. So one of the examples that we looked into was recycling, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Corporations don't like it, like Target. Corporations like Target don't like it when they see plastic bags floating around with that giant Target logo on it. That's bad for their brand.
Yep.
So they're looking for ways to partner with nonprofits that can help them solve that problem, do good for the community, but also sort of solve a corporate issue or problem that they have.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Chronicle spoke with quite a number of leaders who oversee the philanthropy and corporate citizenship efforts of their company. What advice did they offer nonprofits in order for those organizations to be more successful in garnering corporate support?
The thing that they kept coming back to over and over again, different people from different organizations, is that they need to see quantifiable metrics. Businesses really like to see concrete measures of how they succeed or fail as a business, and so they want that from their nonprofit partners as well. So nonprofits who can actually sort of give them very specific and direct feedback on how their corporate philanthropy efforts are working or not working, they find those partnerships particularly valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't it's not that everything has to work, but they want to know what's working and what isn't. They understand that sometimes they're going to fail and things aren't going to work, and then they can change course.
Mm-hmm. They want to see that return on investment. Conversely, did nonprofit leaders share any thoughts on what they believe companies can do better?
Yeah, of course, they had a lot of advice. And one of the things that we heard from nonprofit leaders would be that they'd like more no-strings-attached money or fewer-strings-attached money, which, of course, may be in conflict with what corporations want to do sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other things that corporations could do to make life a little easier for nonprofits, and that would be don't string them along. If the answer is no and you feel badly about saying no to a nonprofit, you're really not doing a service for them. Let them know that it's not going to work out this time and maybe next time so they can move on and target their efforts elsewhere. Another thing that nonprofits really like, they like multi-year funding so that they have a reliable stream of income. If you're asking a nonprofit to maybe change what it does a little bit, maybe do some things a little differently to fit with your corporate plan, it seems like it's fair to give them a few years of reliability in terms of an income stream if they're going to actually be changing their organizations to try to help you out. And one of the other things that came up was provide general operating support. You know, a lot of times, not just companies, but people like to say, I don't want to pay for overhead. I don't want to pay for, you know, all that wasteful paperwork and those sorts of things. But nonprofits have offices to keep running. They have lights to turn on. They have all these expenses like everybody else. And they have a hard time sometimes dealing with all these really restrictive, these restrictions that are oftentimes placed on the money.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a great issue of the Chronicle. You have other stories on corporate giving, such as product giving by U.S. drug companies and the impact that that is having on global health. Thanks for this report, Dan.
Thanks for reading it, Denver, and glad to talk to you anytime.
I'll be back to speak with Mark Abbott, the president of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, right after this.
The Business of Giving is pleased to feature news correspondents every week from the Chronicle of Philanthropy, a trusted source of daily news on the nonprofit world. A subscription to the Chronicle gets you instant access to practical online tools like checklists, resource guides, and expert advice, and in-depth insight into the big ideas and trends that are transforming the nonprofit world. Learn more at philanthropy.com. That's the Chronicle of Philanthropy at philanthropy.com. Top companies have now begun to discover a reliable source for skilled new talent, and they're finding great success with employees who are productive, engaged, and innovative. Explore the country's largest untapped talent pool, 24 million Americans with disabilities. The National Organization on Disability is the leading partner for companies looking to accelerate their disability employment efforts, attract, hire, and retain. Learn more at NOD.org. Welcome back to The Business of Giving with Denver Frederick.
We all learn in school that oceans cover more than 70% of our planet, but there are other things to take note of, such as 50% of the oxygen from photosynthesis is produced in the ocean, 90% of international trade travels by ship, and 44% of the Earth's population live within 100 miles of a coast. There is no organization in the world that explores, understands, and appreciates the oceans quite like Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. And it's a pleasure to have with us their president and director, Dr. Mark Abbott. Good evening, Mark, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Thank you very much, Denver. Pleasure to be here.
Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution was founded in 1930. Give us a brief overview of the organization and how it came to be.
So the organization actually is the offspring of the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole that started in the late 19th century. But in the 1920s, the director of MBL said, we need to do more about the ocean. Scripps Institution of Oceanography was out on the West Coast. He worked with the National Academy of Sciences that produced a report arguing that we needed, for the nation, another oceanographic institution on the East Coast, and Woods Hole Oceanographic was born.
Mm-hmm. And a little over a decade after Woods Hole was born, the country found itself involved in World War II, and the organization forged a very close relationship with the U.S. Navy. What were the kind of things you were called upon to do?
Well, the first was trying to protect the convoys crossing from the United States over to England in the North Atlantic from U-2 submarines. And so we worked to understand how sound was transmitted in the ocean and worked with the Navy to help understand how that could be used to detect German submarines and protect the surface convoys.
Mm-hmm. And is sound and the way it travels impacted by the temperature of the water?
Absolutely. It's dependent on the temperature, on the salinity, on the kind of biological organisms are in there. All sorts of things scatter and help transmit or retard sound transmission underwater.
Mm-hmm. And you continue that relationship with the Navy in a whole variety of ways. I know with the Soviet threat in the 1950s, you were called upon again, correct?
So in the 1950s and 60s, it wasn't German submarines attacking surface convoys. It was very quiet nuclear submarines coming long distances. The U.S. Navy wasn't positioned to understand and deal with that threat. We and other members of the oceans community, the private sector, were called upon to work with the Navy to really help them come up with new strategies and new tactics, many of which the Navy still uses today.
Well, over the years, Mark, Woods Hole scientists have made some seminal discoveries that have impacted so many different arenas, not the least of which has been our quality of life. What have been some of the most noteworthy to you?
Well, many things. And I think the first was understanding the deep sea vents, these vents at the bottom of the ocean that were releasing very hot water and chemicals that really were creating an entirely new life form, what we call chemosynthesis as opposed to photosynthesis,
mm-hmm.
microorganisms that generated energy from chemicals as opposed from sunlight. Now looking at that might explain the origin of life on this planet and perhaps on other planets and moons in our solar system.
You know, much of the oceanography we see on TV is often from the vantage point of a research vessel. Your first vessel was the Atlantis, the profile of which is your institution's logo. Then there was the Alvin, underwater research. And your latest ship is the Neil Armstrong, and the Sally Ride is with your sister organization, Scripps, out on the West Coast that you had just mentioned. Give us an idea of what goes on during these expeditions and maybe what they're doing currently.
Well, when you go to sea, you're usually with in the range of about 20 other scientists. It is a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week adventure.
Hmm.
People are working all the time. It's a lot of interdisciplinary research. You have a lot of equipment over the side and in the water. People are making measurements from the ship. It is intense, and it is not a cruise in the way that you think about going through the Caribbean and visiting exotic ports.
I bet.
It is a lot of hard work. You can't go to the Ace Hardware store when something breaks. A lot of improvisation happens on the ship. But you really build a sense of community. People are all working together to achieve their scientific goals and to understand something new about our ocean.
What are they doing currently, these vessels?
Well, right now, the Atlantis is out in the North Atlantic, just off the U.S. East Coast, avoiding the hurricane that's approaching the Carolinas right now.
Mm-hmm.
The Neil Armstrong is up off Iceland, servicing an array of current meter moorings. So they're out there working hard, not in exotic locations, but they're doing hard work in science and engineering.
And you monitor the ocean with 4,000 floats, which are scattered across the globe. What kind of information are they providing?
So these floats are actually in not only a HUI contributes to them, but the entire nation and the world contribute to this vast array. We have many scientists who are responsible for the deployment and understanding these measurements. We're using them to understand how the ocean is changing in the same way meteorologists measure the atmosphere, to make predictions, understand long-term changes in our ocean circulation and its behavior.
Let me ask you about one of the ocean's hidden frontiers, which is the twilight zone. Where is the twilight zone, and what do we currently know about it?
So the twilight zone is part of what we're calling Project Audacious. It's being run out of the TED organization. Ray Dalio is one of our primary funders for the Twilight
Zone. Ray Dalio being?
Ray is head of Bridgewater, but he's also a passionate advocate for the ocean, trying to create excitement not only in the United States but around the world for the ocean and its importance. The Twilight Zone is really an area that's underexplored. It's potentially a vast resource of animal life. There are nations that are thinking about harvesting that even before we have the basic understanding. So we're out there developing new technology and new science to go out and understand this world. But what's different about the Twilight Zone project is we're not going to do it just for scientists or just for government agencies. We're going to try and make these data available real time for everybody, bring everybody on this voyage of discovery.
Very cool. How far down is the Twilight Zone?
Well, it's the area between about 600 to 3,000 feet. It's called the Twilight Zone because you sort of see sunlight, but you don't really, you can't really photosynthesize. That is, plants can't grow down there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a vast area. It's thought that there may be 10 to 100 times more biomass, living material, in that part of the ocean than we harvest every year.
Mm-hmm. And as you just mentioned, there's some threats that it could be commercially exploited.
Well, you know, that's one of the advantages of the ocean is that you can grow protein very well.
Not, mm-hmm.
It doesn't take as much water, doesn't take as much energy as chicken or beef or pork or whatever. So people want to get protein. The ocean is a great place to do it, but that means you've got to feed the fish that you want to harvest.
Right.
And so you say, where do I get that? And people are starting to look and say, maybe some of that's in the Twilight Zone. The little organisms that live down there are an inch or so shorter. They're not very big. They're nothing you would put on your plate. So people are looking to harvest that to feed to these vast aquaculture farms.
Well, as you observe and measure life in the Twilight Zone, it probably helps that Woods Hole is a leader in underwater robotic systems. How is this changing the way you go about your work, and what new possibilities are emerging as a result of advanced robotics?
That's a great question, Denver. The way we sample with ships, you know, you can go and look at a small area for 3, 4, 6 weeks, and then things, you're not there. Things change, and you say, what happened? It's like walking into a forest for a week or two, studying a very small area and saying, now I understand the entire forest. Robotics allow us to be in the ocean all the time, everywhere, and that's really opening up new windows of understanding. So the robotic revolution has really changed our ability to observe and understand our ocean. The next wave that's coming are the really small consumer sort of things. What we saw in like your smartphone, bringing these smaller, cheaper devices and even increasing the amount of samples that we have to work with. We really are in the century of undersampling of our ocean. We want to change that.
Yeah, so I guess with these sensors, as you say, very powerful, very small, we can really be in constant touch with the ocean.
My vision is to make the always-on, always-connected ocean. We see this in our daily life. It used to be, you know, if you wanted internet access, you had to go to a government lab or a university. Then you had it in your home. Now you have it in your pocket. And that kind of revolution, we want to bring that to the ocean.
Well, this technology has been vital in your work of discovering shipwrecks and buried treasure, such as what some have referred to as the Holy Grail of shipwrecks, that being the San Jose off the coast of Colombia. It's been down there for over 300 years. How were you able to detect it?
Well, again, working on behalf of the Colombian government, we used what's known as a REMUS is the name of the vehicle. It's an mm-hmm. underwater robot. It has a whole range of sensors, and it's able to map the seafloor. And using the data that it collected, we were able to find conclusively evidence of that shipwreck.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, Mark, some general questions about the ocean that I think are probably on a lot of listeners' minds. 90% of the heat from global warming has been absorbed by the ocean. How is that showing up, impacting the ocean waters, ocean life, the ecosystem of the ocean?
Another wonderful question, Denver. That's an area that's obviously right at the heart of a lot of our science. We're seeing it in the reduction of sea ice in the Arctic as the ocean gets warmer. We're starting to see hints, I wouldn't say the evidence is there yet, of changes in ocean circulation, but we're always also seeing a lot of changes in where fish and crustaceans live. There was a fishery now off Rhode Island, Massachusetts, called the Jonah crab. 10 years ago, it was $0 worth of a fishery. Now it's $60 million. These crabs have moved north, taking advantage of changes in ocean circulation. So fishermen are already seeing changes in patterns of their harvest. So they're looking for different kinds of species now than they did 10, 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. So these are really profound effects. It'll be interesting to see how this all unfolds.
Yeah, and I think many people think we're seeing a good number of changes in the weather. Are we getting better at predicting hurricanes and other weather events?
I think absolutely we are. In large part is because the computer models are just much better. The computers are faster.
Mm-hmm.
But we're incorporating more physics, better understanding the atmosphere, but now much better understanding the ocean. Clearly, when we look at hurricanes, the ocean is providing that energy to feed the hurricanes that we see. When the hurricanes go over warm water, they get more energetic. But there's a coupling. As the hurricane sits there, it's mixing the ocean, cooling it off. And that understanding is really being revolutionized, not only by better models, better physics, but by better observations, a lot from our ocean.
Uh-huh. You know, sometimes people, well, such as myself, have this naive notion that the ocean floor is relatively flat. And that's probably because that's what I experience when I go to the beach. But nothing could be further from the truth. What is the ocean floor actually like?
So it is amazing. It's interesting that we probably have better maps of Mars and Venus than we do of the ocean floor. This makes it challenging in many areas. For example, the MH370 flight that we still haven't been able to find. The maps are just not very good. We've had U.S. Navy submarines run into seamounts that nobody knew were there. It is a vast, rugged area. It looks like California or the Himalayas,
yeah.
Canyons, mountains. It's not just this boring, flat, mud flat.
Well, I've had that bubble burst there then, I guess. Let's talk about plastics in the ocean. And boy, this issue just seems to have crystallized in the last couple of years, and particularly with the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, which is an area about twice the size of Texas. What are these plastics doing to the ocean, and what needs to be done to clean it up and to stop it?
Yeah. So absolutely. This is in the last 5-10 years and a whole topic that's really risen to the fore. So we see the plastic waste on the beach. You see plastic bags. You see entanglements of sea turtles and marine mammals. Those are all terrible things that happen. But the other part are the plastics we can't see, what we call the microplastics, the small plastic beads that are in your toothpaste that we didn't know about, or the plastic beads that are used to make larger, you know, lawn chairs and baskets and things. Those are, that material is also getting into the ocean. What's troubling about that is that material can get absorbed by small marine life and then move up the food chain. The impacts, we don't know yet. So the big stuff, the big plastic materials, we see that. I worry that we're not paying attention to the much larger and perhaps more dangerous problem of the microplastics.
Yeah, very interesting observation. You at Woods Hole have revenues close to $250 million. What's the business model and what are the main sources of those revenues?
We're the world's largest institution devoted to ocean research. That's a private company. Most of our revenue comes from grants and contracts written by our 150 scientists and engineers. They're writing their own proposals, usually in collaboration with other scientists, either at Woods Hole or elsewhere. They're businessmen and women. They're entrepreneurs. And that's where most of our money comes from. The rest comes from our endowment or private philanthropy.
Mm-hmm. What would you do if you had more money, you think?
Well, I think this is, that's a always you can always do more with more money.
Yeah.
I think that what we really want to see is more funds, particularly on the private side, to help do more risky science, more exploration and discovery. I think just the entire nation in its research and development enterprise has become much more cautious because budgets get tight. You want to bet on sure things. We need much more of that sort of venture capital entrepreneurship mentality where people say, I've got this great idea, or I'm a young scientist who may not have the track record, but I've got this great idea. We really want to fund that, not even out of the box. There is no box thinking.
Right.
And that is what really has propelled Woods Hole Oceanographic for the last 88 years, and we'd like to do more of that.
Yeah, I can see that. That's probably one of the limitations of having all these contracts, that you're obligated to a certain to do certain things, and you don't have that money that just lets you explore and do different things, and that's where so often the great breakthroughs come.
Absolutely. I would say 20, 30 years ago, that was not the case, that the federal government understood that fundamental investments and to allow bright, curious minds to explore things was going to pay off in ways that you couldn't imagine. We're a lot more cautious now than we used to be.
Yeah. Let me ask you about your corporate culture, Mark, starting with teams and collaboration. And it seems to me that Woods Hole was well ahead of the game in seeing the benefit of bringing together diverse teams. Describe what you believe to be the distinctive features of how your teams work and what has the organization done to create such a collaborative culture.
Great question. And there are lots of different things to do. One is we really think long and hard about the kind of people we hire. Do they have great science, great engineering, great technical skills? That's really straightforward. The best people want to come and work at Woods Hole Oceanographic. But we also look really closely, how do they work together and how can we help them succeed? Not what can they do for the institution, but what can we do for them? That starts to create that collaborative culture where everybody feels like their success really is going to enable the institution to succeed. So it's not this competitive, wow, if I get funding or this other person gets funding, then I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, I want to enable everybody to succeed. The second part is we're playing a much more active role in the whole mentoring and feedback and assessment. So we really work with all of our scientists, particularly those before they get tenure, to mentor them, to provide guidance. I think this is a cultural shift in that people now want even more frequent guidance and working as a team. So we really work on that very, very closely. The next part I think that we're looking at, and again, a little bit of a generational shift, people want to see impact in more ways than just how many scientific papers did you publish where you were the first author. So we want to start to look at what is the importance of their impact beyond just the science. That's obviously the gold standard. But did you engage with students? Did you engage with public agencies? Did you really unlock and enable other scientists to succeed? And again, it's kind of building on that culture. We are on the research cruises, you always have a chief scientist. And that person's job is to arbitrate the often conflicting needs of what the ship should be doing. But their job is to let everybody to succeed. And so you have that kind of cultural value where the community success is beyond just an aggregation of the individuals. Somebody has to actively manage that process.
You have put an emphasis on eliminating barriers to innovation. What are those barriers and what have you done to bring them down?
I think a lot of the barriers are, again, on the way the funding flows. It flows to individual proposals. It tends to reward now more conservative, less risk-taking science.
Mm-hmm.
That innovation really depends on where there are no requirements.
Mm-hmm.
You're out there exploring a whole range of opportunities. So by focusing our private fundraising on those kinds of opportunities, we hope to provide more of that to our scientists and engineers, providing open data access as a policy to the institution.
Speak a little bit about that. That was a big, big move on your part.
Well, I think this is, again, part of a national trend, but we're also seeing by sharing data, what I like to say is you can remix and come up with new understanding. So we're really starting to put that infrastructure into place so that we really become a more of a data and knowledge-driven institution. I like to say HUI is really the premier ocean sensing institution in the world. We really go out and measure and then understand. Getting all of those data sets together in an integrated way allows people to find new patterns and new relationships.
Yeah, great. And just to underscore that point, as of last year, all your research now is available online, right?
That's the plan. I would say that there's some that still lives in notebooks in people's laboratories and offices, but we're definitely, that is the goal. That is where we're headed.
Let me close with this, Mark. With all we've talked about, what do you and your colleagues up at Woods Hole worry about the most as it pertains to the health of the ocean and the vital role it plays in sustaining life on this planet? And what opportunities, perhaps ones that have just recently presented themselves, get you the most excited and are a source of hope and inspiration to you?
Well, I think you talked about them earlier, Denver. The two are the changes in our ocean ecosystem. It really is the lifeblood of the planet in terms of food, in terms of all the things we depend upon. And I worry about our ocean ecosystems becoming a lot less healthy, species going extinct, changes that really disrupt fishermen's lives. And I worry about the whole area of sea level rise and severe storms. Looking at what kind of infrastructure that we have on our waterfront, even down here in lower Manhattan. You know, if sea level rise goes up and we start having more storm surge, what happens to all of that infrastructure that we built, billions and trillions of dollars? The opportunity, I think, though, is really one of changing, again, how we sense and observe the ocean. Don't make it this mysterious planet that's just far away. Really start making that data available everywhere so that we can really begin to understand what's going on, not just a photo on the cover of a magazine that shows some degradation of environment, but really get everybody to see what's going on and help us all participate. I think that robotic, data-centric mindset is really going to transform how we work together and how we begin to see this as an ocean planet, not just a set of individual countries on land.
Yeah, it's almost like a person. Once you understand them better, you do treat them differently, and probably the same holds true for the ocean.
Absolutely.
Well, Mark Abbott, the president of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. How can people stay informed about your work or support it if they should be so inclined?
That's easy. Just go to our website, www.whoi.edu. There are all sorts of materials out there. There's a special website about the Twilight Zone. You can sign up and become a member of our associates or corporation. There are all sorts of opportunities to help support our young scientists and engineers, and even our more senior ones who have great ideas.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have one rich website that I can attest for. Well, thanks, Mark. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks very much, Denver.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
I just finished months of chemo. But I don't want to talk about months. I want to talk about years. Treatments have gotten better, so I'm hoping for good years ahead. That's thanks to research funded by the American Cancer Society. The same folks giving me free rides to treatments, insurance advice, and a place to stay during chemo. I need that stuff like you don't know. And now that you do, please give at cancer.org.
Technology can change lives, but underserved communities around the world have yet to experience all the benefits technology offers. Benetech is a nonprofit whose mission is to empower communities in need by creating scalable technology solutions. Their work has transformed how 500,000 people with disabilities access information, made it easier and safer for human rights defenders to document violations, and equipped environmental conservationists to protect ecosystems. Learn more by visiting Benetech.org. You probably know Sesame Street as the TV show that taught you letters and numbers. But Sesame is so much more. Sesame Workshop is a nonprofit with a mission to help all children grow smarter, stronger, and kinder. Big Bird wants to help, so he started the Yellow Feather Fund to bring education to children in need. You can help too. Visit yellowfeatherfund.org to learn more or make a donation. That's yellowfeatherfund.org. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
Can you help me remember how to smile?
You might be surprised to learn that the first woman ever appointed to serve on the Supreme Court of the United States considers her greatest legacy to be a video game. But that is the importance that Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor places on having an informed citizenry in a democracy. The name of the organization behind these games is iCivics, and it's a pleasure to have with us their executive director, Louise Dubé. Good evening, Louise, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's my pleasure to be here with you.
Sandra Day O'Connor founded iCivics in 2009 when she was just about 80 years old. Now, you don't often think of people that age starting an organization where a video game will be its centerpiece. How did this come about?
It's really an amazing story. So Justice O'Connor was really convinced that the future of democracy rests on having its youngest citizens take up the role of citizen, in that we as adults have an obligation every generation to educate them. And then she went around and looked at what was working and what was not and how we could do it. And she happened to be surrounded by one of her former clerks, Julie O'Sullivan, and as a professor at Georgetown Law School. And Julie had a son at the time, Ben, who was playing video games. So they got together. She saw how he interacted with video games, and she was like, that's it. And we actually have the picture of her with Julie and her son. And it really is an amazing thing that she was open to that. She had never, of course, opened much of a computer in her lifetime.
Oh, yeah.
So she had clerks and other staff to do that. But she really saw the power. She also met with Jim G, a professor of probably the father of educational gaming.
Yep.
And he was really able to convince her that really that process of engagement where you can actually simulate something in real life, but at scale for every kid in America, is the way to engage them in the beginning of what their role will be as citizens.
That speaks so well of Justice O'Connor, and we always thought so highly of her to begin with. And you now have another Supreme Court justice involved with the organization.
We do. Justice Sotomayor is on our board, has served for 3 years. We also work with other members of the court. Obviously, Justice Souter has been a big proponent of civic education. We have worked with Justice Gorsuch as well. It is a very dear to the court's heart, I think.
Well, you know, most listeners probably know that civics education has been pushed a little bit to the side by things like STEM, and young people don't know what they should about government. But what does the research indicate in terms of their understanding of basic civics?
Oh, it's incredibly poor. If you look at the nation's report card, the NAEP, you'll find that we in civics score at the lowest rate, only second to history. So in history, our kids are proficient at about 18%. And in civics, it's 23%. So not much better. They really, most kids, many Americans even, cannot name one of the branches of government. Most can name all three stooges, but not a branch of government. So it's really a very difficult situation that we're walking into, and we're not giving civics education the time in the classroom it deserves. We're actually going in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
So at the elementary level, we have gone from about 10% of the time of the classroom down to 7% since 2004. And we need to change that. So I actually feel like we're at a different stage now, and there is momentum. But I think there is nowhere to go but up.
There you go. So I'd be curious, and we're going to get to a couple of the games specifically, but how do you create an appropriate game for the iCivics library? Now, I understand the needs of the developer, but how do you include both the teachers and the students in the development process?
Oh, that's very interesting. So we have a process that's kind of interesting. We start with the learning standards. So we first start by understanding that a teacher's job is to teach a certain set of curriculum that's required. And that curriculum and the expectations are governed by a set of standards.
Mm-hmm.
From those standards, so we make sure that at the end of the game, the students will have learned the content and the curriculum that was designed, that was prescribed. So that's where we start. We also have 160 volunteer educators that are part of our network, the Educator Network. They are all over the United States and all states, and they apply every year to be a volunteer with us, and we love them very dearly. So we talk to them on a regular or constant basis and try to get feedback from them to integrate their perspectives, talk to them. We also, for new games or for when we redo a game, we have a little smaller set of people, both researchers and teachers, who help us come up with new ways to engage students. So it's an ongoing and collaborative process. We also seek out feedback from kids. So every time we build either a new game or an upgraded game, we go out to classrooms and try to say different settings. So different kinds of kids will have different kinds of feedback. And so we get them to try out an early version of the game and let them tell us what they think. And so that's a nice and collaborative feedback. And I love to see those sessions.
You it's have really to have those sessions, because I'll tell you, what's hot today will be cold tomorrow. So they're the ones who are going to know, not us, that's for sure. What grades do you focus on? And how many students did you reach last year?
So last year we reached 5 million students.
Wow, which congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. About half of where we want to be. So we consider 10 million roughly to be the totality of the population we want to reach. So we have, in terms of grades, we started at the middle school level. So Justice O'Connor's thought was you need to get them early. Civics is pretty hard to read. We have a lot of big words. So we didn't want to start too early.
Yeah.
But middle school was really our sweet spot. From there, we've expanded up to the high school. Most of civics is taught at the high school level. So that's where we are now focusing on. We are developing new resources for high schoolers. But then there are many kids. My kid, I started this because my son, Daniel, played iCivics completely independently in fourth grade. His teacher assigned it as homework. It was in the White House, actually, in 2012. And he was in fourth grade. And so, you know, many kids play it earlier. When they have the reading skills, they can access the game. So we go all the way through third, fourth, fifth grade, all the way through high school.
Well, Win the White House was a game that got an enormous amount of attention a couple of years ago. It's actually where I first became aware of iCivics. How do you play Win the White House?
So you are a candidate, and you are trying to win the national election. So you can declare yourself to be a Democrat or Republican. You have to pick a platform. You can even be a maverick. So you can have your platform be of a Republican platform, but have some Democratic issues. Use in your platform. And then you sort of have, by playing, figure out how our system works. So that's really the sense of educational games. It's we're not going to tell you how it works. You're going to have to figure it out yourself. So you're going to probably figure out that it's probably best to go to the big states.
Yep.
You're going to figure out that electoral college votes is what matters.
Go to purple.
Go to purple, exactly. And you're going to figure out that you're going to have to visit the states. And you're going to have to put in appearances in different ways. You're going to have to decide how much of your campaign budget you're going to spend on ads.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a fairly complex game.
Yeah,
you're going to have to. And it really replicates something. It simulates a process that you could not simulate in the classroom, right?
Mm-hmm.
It would be too hard for a teacher to set that up in her classroom without the aid of technology. And that's really where iCivics' sweet spot really is.
Yeah.
Try to take those complex processes of government in our system and make them easy to access for all kids in the United States so that they build an understanding of how our system works and they find it interesting. So what happened to Daniel was that after playing Win the White House, I saw him pay attention to politics in the way that he never had before. And he's since joined the debate team. And clearly, Daniel would have, had a lot of opportunities. But we want to make sure that these opportunities are accessible to all kids.
Yeah.
So that's really the point, and that's how we do it. We open up that light bulb towards what our system of government means to them, make it relevant to kids.
Yeah, although I don't think Daniel would be a control group. I'm sure he had a little bit of help from his mom.
Yeah. He does want to be a lawyer.
Right. There's been a lot of attention this year on the Supreme Court, and I would imagine with several Supreme Court justices involved, you probably have a game or two about that. What are those?
Supreme decision, where you can play as a Supreme Court justice. So, yes, it's absolutely. We have several law-related games, one called Argument Wars, which is very popular in AP government classes, where you have to pick the best evidence. It's an incredibly difficult game I will not say, but one Supreme Court justice actually picked the wrong answer once. So it's actually quite difficult to get it right. And it is a very useful in trying to build those critical thinking skills that a student has in every discipline of life. That's what's great about civic education. It trains you to know about our system of government and the rule of law, but it also trains you to think in a proper and disciplined way, just like a lawyer would.
Maybe we should be using these games during the hearings to vet candidates. Anything local? Because, I mean, the way kids can get involved and students get involved is probably at the local level. Do you have anything around that?
It is probably my favorite game. So County Solutions is a game where you are the county executive. And residents come to you and ask you questions like, where do I get my driver's license? And also, there are opportunities to grow your town or your county, investment opportunities. And then you resolve problems. So there's a pothole on my street. And how much is it going to cost to fix this pothole? And what benefit is it going to gain for the county? You have your tax base. You have your budget. You cannot go over your budget unless you raise taxes. It sort of creates that sort of accountability mentality.
Decisions.
That students. Yes, exactly. Everything has a cost and a benefit, and the student is asked to make those trade-offs every time that a decision comes to them. And then 4 years, you have to be reelected. Mm-hmm. And if you do not have 50% approval rating, you're not likely to get, and you will not get reelected. And so that the students start to understand how complex these public policy questions are, even in their own towns. So we use that game often to start the process of students doing actual projects in their community. So we simulate this experience, mm-hmm. and then they get exposed to actual projects in their communities, and they take an interest. And that process of action-reaction, meaning that the students do something and get a result, is what has been shown by research to be effective long-term. So that's that sort of cycle of I am more powerful than I think, which is a book by Eric Liu. Mm-hmm. And that process, that kids feel that way, that they have some power and some relevance in the world, is what we need to engage them in the process.
These games start the process, but that process continues. What kind of support do you provide teachers to continue that conversation in the classroom?
Yeah, so that is absolutely the critical thing about iCivic. So a lot of resources are helpful, but they're not helpful if they're not surrounded by support materials so that the teacher has easy access. So we're talking about teacher's biggest concern is time, right? So she can or he can take our materials and easily execute. So they get, in some cases, a PowerPoint presentation where we activate learning to start the classroom discussion. Then the kids play the game. And then we have created some topics of discussion so that there can be a whole class discussion after, so they can apply the learning that they've gained through our games to the real world. So we make that process seamless for the teacher. We also have over 170 lesson plans. That lesson plan is a way for her to go beyond the games. So we have created interactive activities. So, for example, in one case, students will create laws about the regulation of drugs, for example, or something, whatever, some topic that is relevant to them and is linked to a standard. And they will actually take an activity, and we will make that very, very simple for teachers. So that's what iCivics is known for, and making a lot of the civic content available to teachers in an easy-to-use way. So we also provide professional development for educators who sometimes are being asked to teach civics.
And they want it, I know.
Yeah, and in many cases, they really want it, and many of them do not have easy access to civics content. So we teach both the content and the pedagogy and the vocabulary for civics so that they can benefit from our experience, our gained experience about how best to teach civics.
And speaking of easy access, you've put some of your more popular games on apps so they can get them on their phones and their iPads or tablets.
Yeah, so not on the phones, but on the tablets.
Okay.
So that across all the different platforms, Android, Google, and so on. So they can play the games. You know, as you know, in the classroom, we've seen an explosion of these devices.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to make it easy for teachers to use our resources, whatever their platform might be.
You know, I know, Louise, you create these games to be nonpartisan, but that can also be difficult in such a partisan age. I mean, people might look at some of the cases you did with the Supreme Court and say, why did they pick those cases? You know, how people are. Have you run into any partisan pushback in different areas of the country?
We have not, for the most part, but I think it's
good for you.
it's increasingly hard.
Yeah.
A lot of teachers during the election were told that, you know, they could not teach the election because the principals were afraid in this polarized environment. At this stage, I'm hearing more and more teachers want to teach the content, and they are thankful that we are presenting the content from a basis of fact.
Mm-hmm.
What's happened? Why? So why did we pick these court cases? Because they're in our learning standards. So that's how we make our decision. We try, for example, in Executive Command, one of our games about being the president, we try to present the issues. Some issues are what might be more associated with the right position, and some might be associated more with the left. But students are able to pick and explore those issues as they wish. So we try to be balanced, and we try to create the opportunity for a classroom discussion that's based in how the system actually works.
Mm.
So that's how we get around it. Is it an easy for teachers? No, it's not easy at all. They are facing polarized classrooms to start with. But we hope that having the kids go through our content first helps them to manage a civil discussion with all the kids together after. And so, but we have to be realistic that in some cases, some of the kids will obviously express opinions that are polarizing.
Yeah.
And that there is no way around
no,
that.
No, there is no way
because
around
otherwise
that.
It's not relevant. Otherwise
no, we
not
have found that in families. There's no
yes,
way around that.
That's right.
Absolutely. What about cognitive dissonance? And I say that in the fact that you're teaching them civics and how government works. But then they go home at night
right.
And they turn on the TV and they see what's going on in Washington. And there's always that separation between what I've learned and, my gosh, they're not doing any of that here. Yeah. Is there any cynicism around that at all?
Yeah. So I think that has to be acknowledged, right? So
yeah.
That the reality is that you don't want to get too far out from what the reality of the world is, or else kids will think you're completely irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So our answer to teachers has been, You may be right that the system is not working the way that you would like, or even as it is imagined or should have been. And I think that's why we're doing the work that we are. We are doing this work with you to try to get you to understand that this democracy is not going to work
mm-hmm.
without all of us leaning into it. If you don't, if you see the system not working in the way that you think it should work, then I urge you to either get your parents to get involved or ultimately get involved in some, even in small ways in your communities, and start the process of being an active citizen. It doesn't take much, right? It takes doing small, caring for your neighbor,
mm-hmm.
Looking after other people, and living your life according to the values and principles that we as Americans do. So that's been our answer. Is it enough? Sometimes not. That's the only way out of this. And it is a long-term process.
Louise, only about 20% of young people who are learning English have even a rudimentary understanding of civics. And that's a very important population. What are you doing to reach them?
So we obviously, as you we mentioned before, Justice Sotomayor joined our board. It is incredibly important to her that we reach English language learners. These are kids who will face particular difficulties in civics because of the academic vocabulary that we use, right?
Mm-hmm.
An amendment, it doesn't matter if you translate it into Spanish, it is still not an easy concept to understand. So it's not even enough to translate.
Right.
So what we have done is we have taken our games, several of our games, and we have translated them into Spanish, but also provided definitions in their native language so that students from a Spanish background can know what these concepts mean. And you can play either in English or in Spanish, and you can switch back and forth so that when you become more familiar, you can play in English easily. We also offer support for teachers of English language learners. We have such great feedback from our group of English language educators that these resources are helpful. We still do not have enough of our games in Spanish. We are doing them one by one.
Yeah.
But we are hoping to continue the process and have all of our games translated into Spanish.
And it's important to note that all this content is for free. So that puts a little bit of pressure on your business model to generate the money to operate. Who are some of your key partners and supporters?
Yes, we are supported by wonderful institutional funders, Carnegie, McCormick Foundation, the Hewlett Foundation. So these are some of the great supporters of iCivics over the years. You're absolutely right. This is a very difficult business model. Our goal has been to change the business model to rely a little bit less on institutional funders and a little bit more on individual donors. Mm-hmm. So this is not an easy shift, transition. And then there's also the issue of earned revenue. We have not cracked that nut yet, but it is something that we will need to do over time. My goal, certainly, when I came to iCivics, is to secure Justice O'Connor's legacy forever. Mm-hmm. So we have to set up iCivics in a way that will sustain itself long term. And so we've been very successful at that from an institutional funding perspective, but I don't think that's the answer long term.
Mm-hmm.
So we are in that shift. We've been very successful this year. Over 35% of our income came from individual donors. So that's wonderful. We need to expand that, and we need to create a greater percentage of earned revenue.
Yeah. There's only so many institutional donors, and there's a lot of individuals. You're headquartered up in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Tell us about your corporate culture. Mm-hmm. What makes it really special, and how do you maintain it when the organization has been scaling so fast?
Oh, that is such a great question. So we are mainly female.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of former teachers with us. I would describe our corporate culture. I really value our team. It is incredible. It's the best team I've ever worked with. They are both enthusiastic and competent, and they are dynamic and then realistic. So that's the combination. It's pretty much the iCivics brand.
Yeah.
A little bit edgy, but also fun, engaging. Folks are supportive of each other. We do a lot through our team structure, meaning mm-hmm. lots of different people, different hands working on the same project. One of the key aspects is to have somebody who's focused on internal processes when you're talking about growth. And so we brought on Sue Meehan, our COO, CFO, and she focuses on building those institutional structures so that it is less reliant on any one individual, but a culture is now operationalized in a set of structures. So that's the process that we are going in right now in order to meet the demand of explosion in civics and in civic education. As you know, we are also taking on a bigger, broader mission for the whole field, and that's what's putting pressure on our team to grow and to become less dependent on any one leader
mm-hmm.
And sort of own the mission together.
Let me close with this, Louise. What has been the impact of iCivics on students knowing the basic facts about the United States political system, understanding campaign issues, having opinions about those issues, and even becoming involved in the political process?
So we have several third-party independent research that has shown increases in civic knowledge. But the one that's most important to me is that what we really think of as our mission is to turn on the light bulb so that the process of students understanding that the government is relevant to them mm-hmm. and the rule of law is relevant to them opens up this lifelong involvement in political process and system of government. So one of the research that one third party did showed that 45% of the kids who came to iCivics were exposed to iCivics in the classroom, went home, and actually played it unprompted. So that process of engagement without prompts from your parents or anybody else is really what we're looking for. They don't have to play it forever, but they have to want and find that process engaging. And so we're proudest of that. And I think it demonstrates that kind of process of I'm important. Mm-hmm. I make these decisions. In iCivics, you're always at the center of the action. You are making the decision. And I hope that kids feel that ultimately they are the center of our democracies. So
it turns out there are a lot of other Daniels out there. Well, Louise Dubé, the executive director of iCivics, I want to thank you so much for being on the show this evening. Where can people find out more about these video games or become one of those individual donors you're looking for?
Oh, what a great question. Thank you for that one. So iCivics.org is super easy. You can play your games right there without registering, without doing anything. Play our games. If you're a teacher, you should sign up and register for a free account. That opens up the world of all of iCivics' resources. And then at the top, there is a Donate Now button. And please... if you can help us out, every dollar is put to good use to build materials for the classroom, and appreciate the opportunity.
Well, thank great you to so have you much. On the show. Thanks so much for being here, Louise.
Thank you.
And that is this week's show. Next Sunday, my guest will be Sean Mayberry, the executive director of Strong Minds. They are having amazing results treating an epidemic that has heretofore been completely ignored. That is depression among women in Africa. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. And do return next Sunday evening for the Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of the Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.